Hello, and welcome to Swiss Literature Today, a series showcasing contemporary literature from Switzerland. This series is made possible with kind support from the Consulate General of Switzerland in New York and Swiss Arts Council Pro Helvetia. In this episode, host Andrew Singer talks with German author Julia van Lukadu about her dystopian novel The High Rise Diver, published by World Editions, an English translation by Sharmila Cohen. Andrew began by asking her how she came to writing fiction.
So I've actually always wanted to become a novelist. As a young girl, I always dreamed of being an author. And my parents would always tell me, that is not a job. You cannot make money that way. Don't do it. And so I studied things sort of adjacent to the creative arts. I studied film and television and radio and theater. And I worked in those industries before, and before I started writing my first novel, I was working in the German television industry for an independent production company. And there I was part of that whole sort of performance society that I describe in the book. I had sort of internalized that ideology of me being only as valuable as the productivity I put out there. And that was becoming really unhealthy for me, and I felt really trapped in that situation. And I was working nonstop. I didn't have any free time anymore, and my entire identity was built on this work as a television producer. And when I realized that, I started sort of questioning my own values and became interested in finding out what was the motivation behind that. And that's when I quit that job and wrote this book to sort of investigate.
So that experience feeds directly into the psychological drama, which this book expresses so well. That's, in a sense, some autobiographical experience, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because the book is clearly not very autobiographical, being science fiction or speculative fiction, dystopian novel. But it does draw from my own experience pretty heavily, I think, as all novels do in a way. But I think it's mostly my fascination with the sort of psychology of societies and the psychology of individuals. I grew up in a household with two psychologists, so that really left an impression on me. And I grew up studying these books, psychology books, and I'm so fascinated with it. So,
how many psychologists does it take to change a light bulb?
I'm not sure. A lot.
The answer is one, but the light bulb has to really want to change.
That's a good one. It's so true.
So there is a psychological level of reality which has transferred to this novel, and I think brilliantly so. You've chosen really a quite a suitable medium for expressing that. There's a density and a claustrophobia and a slight otherness about narration, which is striking from the very beginning. You know, there's a depth to that that psychological layer which is palpable as we read it.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that. That was the intention.
And a kind of shock of recognition that all of these elements of machine life and social control are creeping in around the edges, maybe a slight bit more extremely in your novel, but really in a recognizable form. And you use so many different techniques and tropes for driving home that this is the world that we're in or barreling into. I mean, you know, so many little recognizable turns of phrase in terms of what we are already needing to do in our interacting with machines. And even, you know, that a certain phrase has a little trademark symbol on it and really nice touches like that give it a fantastic atmosphere, you know, and a recognizable one.
Yeah, I sort of felt when I was writing it in the beginning, I didn't even know it was going to be a dystopian novel. I just started writing about the present, essentially. But I love to sort of exaggerate or condense reality to understand it better. And that's how I could express my unease with certain developments much more clearly. And that's what makes it, in the end, dystopian, because it's a lot of the things I describe are not the reality yet, but they are based on things that we already have or are already facing.
set this up for us a bit. So there's a character named Riva, and there's a character named Hitomi. Who are they? What's their relation?
So Riva is the high-res diver of the title. This is a sport I invented for the book. So it's a mix of base jumping and high diving. And it's a woman who jumps from a high-res building in a fly suit, is the term in the book, that enables her to fly back up at the very last moment, so right before she would hit the ground and die, she can fly back up. And this is a very popular sport in the world I'm describing, because it's exciting, you know, the risk of death to face that. And people like Riva, who are very successful at it, are real stars in this society, star athletes. So she is a famous figure. And all of a sudden, in the beginning of the book, and this is where it starts, she stops jumping, and her sponsors and her trainer are very interested in getting her back on track because they make a lot of money with her sponsoring contracts. And so they hire the second protagonist, Hitomi, who is a psychologist. And she is fresh from the academy. She's a young woman, essentially same age as Riva. And this is her first big job. It's a very high profile job. She gets to observe this famous woman in her apartment via security cameras and analyze her behavior, analyze her data that has been collected over all her life, and try to figure out what went wrong and how to fix her and bring her back to her job and to jumping and to success.
We can talk more about the relation between these two women in a moment and how it plays out in the novel, but perhaps you could read from the beginning of this novel for us, and so we can hear a bit of it.
Stellen Sie sich die Welt vor. Stellen Sie sich die Erdkugel vor, wie sie im Weltraum schwebt. Aus Ihrer Sicht ist die Welt rund und glatt. Genießen Sie diese Gleichmäßigkeit. Stellen Sie sich vor, dass sie nur für Sie existiert. Schließen Sie für einen Moment die Augen, atmen Sie tief ein und aus, und wenn Sie die Augen nach einigen Sekunden wieder öffnen, betrachten Sie die Erde noch einmal ganz neu. Zoomen Sie nun ein wenig näher heran. Sie können Fehler in der Gleichmäßigkeit der Erdoberfläche erkennen, Erhebungen und Senken. Sie bilden ein weiches, wellenförmiges Relief. Die Wechsel von Rot zu Blau zu Braun ergeben ein meliertes Muster.
Imagine the world. Imagine the globe floating in space. From your vantage point, the world is round and smooth. Enjoy its uniformity. Imagine that it exists only for you. Close your eyes for a moment. Take a deep breath in and out. After a few seconds, open your eyes again and consider the Earth anew. Now zoom in a little closer. You can make out irregularities in the evenness of the Earth's surface, elevations and depressions. They form a soft, undulating relief. The shifts from red to blue to brown create a mottled pattern. As you get closer, a silver fleck stands out against this earth-colored display. What you see here, from afar but steadily approaching, is a city. It glistens because it is made of glass and steel. You can see that now. The city lies beneath you like a secret waiting to be revealed. So zoom in at ease. Don't be shy. You're allowed to look. You find it reassuring to see that the city also maintains a sort of uniformity. The buildings conform to an architectural style and are arranged geometrically in rectangular and star formations. Side by side, the almost delicate-looking skyscrapers are indistinguishable as they reach up into the atmosphere. The city is now unfolding beneath you, an infinite sea. And yet it has an end, an edge, back there, where clouds of dust and exhaust fumes rise into the sky. Must it be this way, you think? Must the beautiful city be tainted by the sight of filth? Why must it end anywhere at all? But can you imagine the sea without the beach or the cliff or the pier? No. Without the peripheries, without its repulsive exterior, the city, now shimmering in the orange afternoon light, would only be half as beautiful. Concentrate on the center of the city. One of the skyscrapers rises above the others by several dozen floors. There's a color deviation around the building. At first, it looks like an image error, but then, as you zoom in, it turns out to be matter, moving, alive. Between the structures, you can see a swarming cluster. Densely packed heads, a crowd of people. It vibrates, the heads move, and then you see what the crowd is waiting for down there. There's a glittering object on the roof of that imposing tower. In the close-up, you realize it's a woman in a silvery suit. The fly suit conforms to the contours of her well-toned physique, making her every curve and shape visible so that she appears almost naked. Consider the woman's face. What a face, you think. So symmetrical, as if someone had just created half and then mirrored it. It's a young face. The woman is maybe 20 years old, you suppose, at the height of her beauty. Her body taut, her eyes wide open. Look closely at those eyes. You will not find a single blemish. No redness, no clouding of the irises, or unequal pupil dilation. Instead, sharp focus, concentration. What you see is a professional athlete at work. Every one of this woman's muscles is under control. If you asked her to describe the feeling in her right big toe, she could do so with great precision. At this very moment, a jolt passes through her body. She moves to the edge of the roof. It's time. Maybe you would like to pull away a little, out of the close-up, and open up your view to what lies below. The corridor between the buildings is a 1,000-meter drop. Precisely 1,000 meters of altitude as defined by the guidelines of the Global Committee for High-Rise Diving. The audience holds its breath as the woman steps to the outermost edge of the flat roof. She has a supernatural glow in her fly suit. The people on the ground and in the viewing boxes on the opposite building, all the way up to the skybox, reach their arms up towards her. What you're experiencing is a physical manifestation of euphoria. It pulsates between the buildings. Close your eyes. Let it infect you. Feel what's happening inside you. Feel it down to your fingertips. Feel your heart throbbing as the feeling spreads throughout your body. When you open your eyes, the woman is diving headfirst from the skyscraper roof. At first, you're scared. Your body tenses up as if it were falling beside her. But then you see the diver as a bird in flight. You feel her absolute certainty that she will be able to withstand the fall. You follow the falling body, stay close to it. You see how it rotates around itself with perfect precision, first horizontally, then vertically, twisting into a ball and then stretching out again within fractions of a second. In the next moment, you see the ground. It fills your field of vision. You hold your breath. She's plummeting towards it, threatening to crash. The hot, sun-drenched asphalt is already palpable when her body suddenly shoots up, lifted by the flysuit's flight mode, triggered at the last possible moment, fractions of a second before impact. You hear the air being released from the open mouths of the audience, a collective exhale. The crowd applauds. The diver shoots like an arrow into the sky. In flight, she smiles into the cameras, a weightless figure. Imagine how this woman feels, falling into the depths with unwavering certainty, knowing you will take flight again, without any fear of impact, of obliteration. You enjoy defying gravity. Death can no longer harm you. What a feeling, weightlessness. What a sublime feeling. Now back away again. Zoom out slowly, carefully, without shaking so that the movement remains pleasant to the eye. Imagine that the body between the buildings rises and falls again and again, even when you can no longer recognize it as a body, when it's just a spot in motion, then a point, a possible pixel error, and then nothing at all. You zoom out and see the globe floating in space again, uniform and calm. Imagine the body in its eternity, immortal, its continuous rising and falling, like breathing, like a pulse. Savor this thought. Take refuge in it. Draw confidence from it. Now, in this moment, as you slowly withdraw from the world, there is no death, only life.
That was the beginning of the novel The High-Rise Diver by Julia von Lukadu, read first in German and then a longer passage in English translation by Sharmila Cohn. And this book is coming out next year by World Editions. So, Julia, that's a very dramatic and riveting opening, but apparently the main character, as you've just told us, has some misgivings about her role in her career in society. To what extent is that aspect of it explored psychologically, or what can you tell us about that?
Well, that's sort of the main question of the book. That's what Hitomi has to find out. And I think as a reader, or I hope as a reader, we figure it out much quicker than her. Because the problem is that the narrator, Hitomi, has been essentially brainwashed by the society she lives in. And she cannot perceive that someone that successful would willingly give up a glamorous life like she has, and the status attached to it, and the beautiful apartment attached to it. Because in this world, the people who are successful get to live in this glimmering city, but the people who don't have to go back to the peripheries, which we encounter in the beginning as well, in the passage as well. And so she can't believe that anybody would give that up. She dreamt her whole life of achieving such fame and such status. And so I think it's also a question of how do we get over ideologies that we're brought up with, values that we're brought up with? How can we begin to question them? And why do we begin to question them? And Riva is a good example for that. I think in the beginning, she might not even know herself why she quit her job. She just feels it's not right for her, but she can't really vocalize it. But as we watch her together with Hitomi in the book, I think we get a better understanding of what happened to her and also what's happening to other people around her through the eyes of Hitomi, who might not understand it as well as we do.
And by extension, of course, what's happening to us in our societies, because all of these elements that you're describing are elements encroaching on our reality as we're living now. You say you started writing this book not knowing that it was speculative fiction. How did that process of writing evolve for you?
Well, I think I've been thinking about this issue or these issues and these characters for a long time. I sort of carried them within me for a while before I actually started the writing process. And so I had the first character I conceived with was Riva, because she sort of embodies that crisis that I described in the beginning that I had myself, where I felt overwhelmed by my own expectations of myself, and also with the success that I was having and how much it haunted me and made me feel like the proverbial hamster. I don't know if you have that saying in English, but in German you have this image of a hamster running in its wheel.
Right.
Yeah. And so I think by the time I actually started putting pen to paper, I was already much further in the self-reflection and in the analysis of the society that we live in. And I had read a lot about it. And so then I was already at that level of a bit of dystopia, you know, like I wrote the first scene where Hitomi is watching Riva for the first time in her apartment, and it wasn't set in a futuristic society yet, but by the second chapter it already was, sort of. Like, it evolved sort of naturally. It's hard to describe. I kept reading these interesting articles about technologies that were transforming our lives and our identities and our psyches, and reading about them felt futuristic. Like a lot of the things that are in the book, for example, you can rent family members because people feel very isolated and lonely. And this is a thing that actually exists in Japan, where you can rent family members for years and years. There was a very interesting New Yorker article about a woman who had rented a fake father for her daughter for, I don't know, like 15 years, and the daughter didn't know that he wasn't her real father. And so sometimes it's hard to distinguish between reality and science fiction, I feel.
To oversimplify for a second, there are kind of two main traditions or strands or types of speculative or science fiction. The one where it's the plot which is so overarchingly important, and like a clockwork mechanism, it unravels. The other kind of speculative fiction or science fiction that we've inherited is the tradition where it's the atmosphere which is all important. If we want to exemplify those two in a cinematic tradition, the former is a kind of Star Wars template, and the latter is a kind of Blade Runner template, you know, and the latter is a much more right brain or much more oppressive, atmospheric experience. And it's not that all science fiction falls into one category or the other, but writers do seem to have certain stronger impulses in one direction or the other. And you're certainly here in the right brain Blade Runner second category of atmosphere here. It's brilliantly written to evoke this feeling from the very start of the novel all the way through. That's one of the strengths of the writing, I would say.
Well, thank you. Atmosphere is so important to me personally in art. My favorite films are the films that almost have no plot at all, but just have this very strong feeling that they convey, and it's infectious, and you feel completely inside the character. And so that's my top goal, to reach that type of atmosphere that envelops you and haunts you. Yeah.
It is the encroachment, the incessant encroachment of all of these elements that are hurtling us into a kind of hybrid existence or partly cyborg existence, where we are coexisting with these machines and also the implied societal surveillance that accompanies it, which this book is throwing into sharp relief. How do you feel about the underlying sociological concerns that you're expressing here? I mean, they're very, you know, in a way, foregrounded.
Yeah, I am very concerned about the invasion of privacy by digital technologies. That's definitely one of the things that worry me the most, because it's something I feel that's happening very quietly and doesn't put people in a lot of discomfort, because it actually increases the comfort level in a lot of places. You know, it makes things easier to have your devices tell you what you want to buy next. And it's slowly sort of creeping in, this control. And we're not really suffering from it yet, you know? We don't live in China, or I don't live in China, where that is used like very blatantly to discriminate, persecute, and maybe even kill people. So we don't feel it yet, but I feel it very strongly, and I'm very concerned about my very sensitive personal data being exposed to private companies that have mostly their shareholders to answer to and are mostly concerned about profits, even though they always tout that they're just trying to make the world a better place. I don't think that's true. And also in the hands of governments, and we can see in autocratic states what that means and what power that gives people who don't have our best interests at heart. And I think it's very important that we recognize the value of our data. It's a new thing. I mean, we're not used to the huge amounts of data that we're creating every day. We can't keep up with it, and I think we have to.
Why don't we listen to another passage from this book, and you can start it off in German, and then we'll hear a longer such passage in English.
So this is a scene where Hitomi, the main character, is having a lot of problems with insomnia. During the book, she keeps having a lot of headaches and sleeping problems and other health issues, which are related to her being a workaholic and not doing anything else, I think. And this is seen as a weakness. It hinders productivity. So she's always trying to get over it and optimize herself and fix these issues. But it often doesn't work for her. And then this scene, she tries a new approach, something that's that she herself might regard as another sign of weakness. She tries to communicate with a mother. This is not her own mother, because the parent-child relationships in this book are a little bit estranged. A lot of people are not even born by humans anymore. And so she has lost contact with her so-called bio mother. And instead she calls a mother bot, so a chat bot, to replace her mother in this instant and get a bit of comfort in a situation where she feels very lonely and insecure.
3:17 klicke ich die App eines Parent-Bots. Ich verwende entsprechend meinen vertraglichen Vorschriften zusätzlich zu den üblichen Sicherheitsmaßnahmen einen Scrambler. Während des Gesprächs habe ich trotzdem das ungute Gefühl, von einer Stimmanalyse-Software identifiziert zu werden. »Hallo, mein Schatz«, sagt der Bot. Ich habe die Mutteroption gewählt. Die Stimme simuliert eine etwa 50-jährige Frau mit einem warmen, dunklen Stimmton und einem ruhigen, beinahe behäbigen Duktus. »Hallo.« »Was ist los, Kleines?«
At 3:17 a.m., I click on a ParentBot app. As is required by my contract, I use a scrambler in addition to the usual security measures. Regardless, I still feel uneasy about being identified by voice analysis software during the conversation. Hello, my darling, the bot says. I've chosen the mother option. It simulates a woman around 50 years old. Her voice has a warm, deep tone and a calm, almost sedate cadence. Hello. What's the matter, darling? I'm always surprised by how quickly you forget you're talking to a machine during the conversation. The voice and ability to respond are practically indistinguishable from actual human beings. For my final thesis paper, I investigated the phenomenon under worse technical conditions. Even then, after just a few seconds, the test subjects showed signs of basic trust, similar to that felt towards a friend. Even if they deliberately concentrated on the fact that they were talking to a bot once a minute, and used the memory function on their tablet, even then, they would forget about it from 1 minute to the next. I can't sleep, I say. I'm sorry to hear that. Did you try taking a sleeping pill? Yes. Are you thinking about something in particular that's keeping you awake? My work. The voice at the other end laughs. Then you're working too hard again, my dear. I'm stuck. You don't have to get anywhere this second. That's true. Well, I'm proud of you. Whether or not you make any progress, the voice says. I let her words resonate in me. I feel a little better already. Maybe if I talk to her for a while, I'll be able to fall asleep after all. But you can't stop thinking about it? She asks when I don't respond. I can't stop thinking about it. Would it help to talk about it? I think so. For a moment, I listen to the silence on the line. Then I say, she makes me angry. Who? My subject. She shouldn't make me angry, but she makes me angry. The mother makes a sound confirming she has heard, understood. I'm happy to hear her voice. At night, along with the darkness, I often feel like there's an audio filter between me and my surroundings. Suddenly, it's as if I'm the only person left in the world. The muffled sounds I hear through the walls and ceiling of my apartment seem like apparitions. An echo of the dead, the quiet whirring of the cooling wall, a vibrating hum in the walls, mechanical clicking. The only times I feel connected to the living again are when my tablet rings and I hear the voice of a client on the line. It doesn't make sense, I say, that such a successful woman, known for her desire to perform, suddenly throws away everything she's earned. I understand, the voice says, which sounds a bit like my own mother if I remember correctly. Only the vocal timbre is different, more attentive. We've drifted apart, my bio mother said before she stopped responding to my calls and messages. My high scores never really impressed her. She seemed to object to something more fundamental about me that I could never figure out. I had hoped you would progress further, she said in our last conversation. That you would do more with your life, considering it came at such a high premium. A life at such a high premium, I say to the bot. Life is valuable, the voice answers. You're right, my darling. Life is the most valuable thing we have. And what if it's an actual woman talking to me? What if someone is sitting in a dark room at the other end of the line, someone who really cares about me? What exactly are you angry about? The woman asks. I'm not sure, I say. Maybe it's that she's ungrateful. A defiant child who's been given a lollipop but throws it on the ground because it's not the right flavor. You want to shake her and scream that things have never been as good as they are today. You're right, the bot says. I'm glad that you've grown into such a reasonable woman. What did I always tell you as a child? We should consider ourselves lucky. Yes, Mom, I say. Exactly. We should consider ourselves lucky.
That was Julia van Lucadu reading from her novel The High-Rise Diver. First, her reading a bit in German, and then a longer passage read in English, translated by Sharmila Kohn. And this is will be available from World Editions. One thing which is evoked in this passage is a kind of social score or credit score or psychological score, which is kept by presumably a governing body. Is this something that has shown up in your research and which is already of concern for you in the world? Or what's your take on that?
Yes, that was definitely so this credit score was definitely inspired by what's happening in China right now, where they do have such a score that they use to discriminate against people who are not conforming. And that is very worrying. But I'm also worried about another type of control that we experience in a country like Germany, in a country like the USA, where the power is more on the side of private companies, and they have a sort of not so obvious power that seems to govern us in a lot of aspects as well. And they can directly influence our behavior. They are planning to do this on a much larger scale. In 2018, there was an internal Google video leaked called The Selfish Ledger that explained to the Google employees their vision of the future, where users of smartphones are essentially just governed completely by their smartphone or by the algorithm created, it creating their life goals. And that's a scary vision for me as well. It doesn't even have to be a government in the sense of a dictatorship. I think we can be governed by capitalist interests pretty strongly as well. And another aspect that worries me, that's true for China as well as Germany and the US, is that policing of ourselves and the policing of our peers. And you mentioned social media earlier, I think. And we can see there that these types of scores and evaluations of our bodies and our lives are already happening. And we're sort of measuring our success as individuals on our likes and shares. And you can use that against people as well. You can deliberately not like someone's video because you have a personal problem with them. We have instances of influencers who speak out against bigotry or something, who come from a more conservative background, and they're ousted. They lose all their followers, and this is their way of making money, right? Earning their living. So this is also something that concerns me, that we ourselves opt into that system and become part of it and also use it against ourselves. For example, Instagram is a good example of where you can make yourself very, very unhappy very quickly, you know, by logging into Instagram, looking at everyone who's much prettier, who's much healthier, who's much happier, and feeling inadequate. Because these are filtered images, they don't really show the reality. But we all know that, and still we feel inadequate.
I don't know if you're familiar with the book Surveillance Capitalism, It came out just about a year ago by an academic, Shoshana Zuboff. And it's a sort of a book where she talks about these things in terms of the private sector in the West and how those encroaching reality is accumulating in a certain direction, which supports a kind of late-stage capitalist system of control through technology. And it's a terrifying book and a wake-up call as well.
Yeah, I'm so glad that scientists are looking at it and communicating these issues. But we really have to react.
To do this in culture, in a novel form, is definitely a keen contribution to the conversation because it makes us experience it palpably. Much as, for example, in a previous age, 1984 from George Orwell, just drove it home because it synthesized it in a fiction which is a meta-reality and which at once we can allow into our consciousness because we know it's not real. But at the same time, in that same process, it communicates real social concern, and sometimes speculative fiction, science fiction, is the exact right medium for that kind of social philosophizing. And I think you've really hit it with this book. Have you had any reaction to it in published in original language? How are people taking it?
Let me just first say something that I thought of while you were talking, because I sometimes ask myself, why didn't I write an essay about it, or like a nonfiction text, right? Because you mentioned this really good book about surveillance and private sector. And I think the reason why I chose to write a novel is that it enables you to sort of learn empathy, right? And to understand emotionally why we as people act the way we act and how developments like this come to be. And I chose as a main character a person who I don't identify with a lot, right? He to me is very controlled person who is controlling others, who is hurting herself and others, who is implementing these very unfair rules and enforcing them in a horrible way. But by sort of getting into her head and really letting her explain herself and understanding her better, we can maybe understand better why systems like China actually flourish, right? Because we always have these science fiction novels that tell you the story of the hero who breaks with the system, but most people don't. I mean, I come from Germany. We just very recently in our history had two horrible systems of oppression where most people didn't do anything. And to me, it's important that we understand why and that we understand what the appeal is of such controlled systems. And that's, I think, you can do that in a nonfiction, in a scientific environment, but I think I personally can understand it better if I actually get into the head of a character and I really empathize with them and I try to understand their motivations and emotions.
You mentioned that you're German. How is it that you ended up writing a Swiss novel? It won the Swiss Book Prize, as I understand it. What makes you Swiss in this context?
So I lived in Switzerland while I wrote this novel. I actually studied at the Swiss Institute for Literature, which is a writing program similar to the creative writing programs in the US, which we don't have a lot of in Europe. There's this one writing program in Switzerland, and then there's two or three more in Germany and one more in Austria. So it's not that common here. And they have a very good program there, and I went there to study there. And by living in Switzerland for more than 3 years, I qualified for the Swiss Book Award and for the Swiss Book Prize. And that's how I fortunately became a Swiss writer. But now that I'm not living in Switzerland anymore, unfortunately, I do not qualify anymore. So I have to give up that privilege, unfortunately.
I hope you don't have to give back the prize or anything like this.
I hope not. Don't tell them.
Right. Yeah, no, your secret is safe here, of course. What's been the reception of this book in original language? Have you had any constructive or fascinating feedback?
Yes, I've had a lot of constructive and fascinating feedback. The best part about publishing my novel was the feedback that I got from people who read it. Because I never imagined when I was writing it that I was going to actually talk to someone who read this book, right? I didn't even know if it was going to be published. And because it's my first novel, it's a completely new experience for me. And it's just absolutely amazing. I have very different responses, but a lot of people do share my unease, and do feel like we need to talk more about these issues. And I've had a few people come up to me and say, I'm gonna turn off my phone for a while and think about how I can protect myself better. But it was mostly just like a very human connection, because I'm not dealing with the media very well either. It's not like I have all the answers or I know better. It's more that I see the problem and then I'm asking, can anybody help me? And I see my writing as the start of a dialogue. So, you know, it's a form of communication. I write this, this expresses my opinion or my worries, and then somebody else reads it and answers and says, maybe this is what we could do, or I have this thought about it. Have you looked at it from this angle? And that's what I love about it.
One can only hope that the book will serve this function as well when it comes out in English. It's coming out by World Editions next year in 2021. And it is certainly worthy of reading because it is pitched in a psychological way. It's not directly challenging, as you say, in an essayistic kind of way. But as a psychological drama, it hits a layer of the problem which I think is uniquely expressible in fiction and which really resonates in the work. And I hope it does reach an audience in English and serves similarly as a kind of conversation starter and a motivator, because that's one of the greater roles of culture. Of course, we want our cultural artifacts to be masterful and beautiful and attractive and entertaining. But beyond that, of course, if they serve a social function, all the better. And I think this work is squarely in that category. So I wish you all the best for it in English as well.
Well, thank you. One of my big heroes, literary heroes, is Margaret Atwood, and I really admire her for being very boldly political as a person, you know, and as an author, but at the same time being very entertaining. So I aspire to that as well, you know. I want to be Margaret Atwood one day.
Let's hope. She's definitely an icon in this field, and we need more of them. You know, this is a valuable part of our cultural conversation, and a wonderfully entertaining work. I'm so glad to see it. Yulia, thank you so much for talking with us today.
This has been a discussion with Yulia van Lukkadoo about her novel The High-Rise Diver, available in English from World Editions. We've also heard the translator, Sharmila Cohen, reading excerpts from this work in English. You've been listening to Swiss Literature Today, a series showcasing contemporary literature from Switzerland. Support for this series comes from the Consulate General of Switzerland in New York and Swiss Arts Council Pro Helvetia. This series is executive produced by Traffica Europe Radio. Thanks for listening.